Perspective is recorded in WPFW studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
WPFW News, I'm Sue Goodwin, and co-hosting this hour is reporter and producer Noah Portner. This is usually when you would be listening to We the People with David Whetstone, and he will return next week. Today, we bring you special programming on the genocide in Gaza. During the next hour, you'll be hearing pieces about the intersection between race and war in Gaza, and about journalists who sacrificed their lives to cover the war, and about committed activists using boats to break Israel's blockade on urgently needed aid. Noah Portner will introduce you to our first piece.
Thanks, Sue. Another global Samud flotilla has departed from Barcelona to deliver aid to embattled Gaza. The strategy of the flotilla is to try and run the Israeli blockade and deliver aid to the coast, although garnering major media attention is another, more practical goal. The global Samud flotilla movement started in 2006 as activists protested Israel's invasion of Lebanon. The first flotilla was launched in 2008, with several ships reaching Gaza. Since 2008, several other fleets have been launched, packed with activists and supplies. However, in the years since the first flotilla, Israeli vigilance has greatly increased, with the Israelis operating and intercepting in international waters. These ships are carrying aid such as baby formula and flour, and all are unarmed. The Israeli government have accused the flotilla of anti-Semitic hate and also for being Hamas spokespeople. Although these freedom flotillas have been conducting humanitarian work for over a decade, the current situation in Gaza is far more dire than ever before, with this aid being truly life-saving. The Israeli fleet, of course, plans to block the flotilla and arrest all the activists on board. This includes several high-profile people such as Greta Thunberg and the former mayor of Barcelona. When the previous flotilla in June was stopped, the activists on board were detained in Israel for several days before being deported. Most of the activists were deported from Tel Aviv by air, but two of them, a Middle Eastern man and a black man, were dropped off at the border of Jordan. Here is one of those two men, Chris Smalls, being interviewed by WPFW host Verna Avery Brown.
You listen to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. I'm speaking with labor activist organizer Chris Smalls, who just returned from a mission to deliver food to the starving people of Gaza. Chris Smalls, badass labor organizer, go from giving Amazon a beatdown at two of its shops to boarding a freedom flotilla to Gaza. I suppose your mom had made the adjustment of having you become a nationally known good troublemaker, labor organizer, but how did you respond? How did she respond to you risking your life and your freedom by going to Gaza?
Oh man, she didn't really take it that well. I mean, it's still a learning experience for her and learning curve for her. Even despite me taking on Amazon, which, you know, that was even a shell shock. I didn't tell my mom right away that I was even going on this mission because I already knew, you know, my mom would have tried to do everything in her power to talk me out of it. And I knew that it will cause a lot of stress. So I tried to hold off as much as possible. And it wasn't until I was already in Italy getting ready to set sail before my mom caught wind that I was going. And yeah, you know, just like any mother, she was concerned and worried for my safety, especially, as you mentioned, being the only black man on board. There was an added, intense, heightened sense of stress. But I'm glad that she was able to not only support me, but also find a support network with the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. They had all the family members of all the passengers in one chat. So she was able to confide in them and really, you know, ask as many questions and feel until she felt like she was good and calm.
And so tell us about the trip. 21 activists from all over the world on that boat. And you, how are you feeling? Were you nervous?
No, I wasn't nervous. I'm optimistic. Obviously, after taking on Amazon and taking on the richest man in the world, I had a lot of optimism about this mission. I know the history shows that we would be intercepted or kidnapped. And but even with, despite all of the odds against us, I felt different about this mission because we had seven Americans on board, one third of the crew was Americans. I felt like the cards were sort of in our favor. Maybe not to break the siege, but to get to the Gaza Strip was always in the back of my mind. Like, we're going to actually get there. And I tried to keep that optimism through and through so that I wouldn't get nervous or afraid. And, yeah, my crew also the same mission. We all uplifted each other's spirits and morale, and we all were pretty much optimistic about it.
So when did the Israelis actually enter the boat?
July 26th, that Sunday, at 11 p.m. You know, we were sailing all day, and this is why I was continuing to be optimistic, because we already had surpassed the last flotilla, which was 150 miles out from Gaza when they were kidnapped. We were fortunate enough to make it into Palestinian territories. We made it less than 60 miles away. So I was extremely optimistic on that Sunday. But I knew once the sun go down, I think we all knew once the sun go down, things is going to take a turn. And we were right. You know, we knew that they would come, you know, in the middle of the night like they did with the Madeleine.
So you knew they would come for you. Were you all prepared to defend yourselves, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a nonviolent type of method. It's not really defense, because obviously there is a history there with the IOF killing activists on these flotillas and bombing the boat 2 months ago to Conscious. And also with us in particular, we already had some sabotage attempts on our lives, leaving the port of Gallipoli. So it's more nonviolent, but we were prepared. We had extensive training for a number of weeks. So, yeah, we were ready for whatever was to come.
Well, so were you all trained to be silent and comply and not resist in accordance with, you know, nonviolence protocols throughout history?
Not silent. And also, I wouldn't say non-resistance. We did resist in our own way. We weren't silent at all, though. We were locked arms. That's a way of resistance. We were singing. We were actually singing when they came on board. We were singing Bella Child, which is you know, a song that is in the movement for empowerment. So we did our own methods of resistance. And of course, what people don't know, on board, at point in times, they tried to separate a few of us, but we didn't allow them to. We didn't allow them to isolate anybody. We stayed together the entire time. And yeah, we protected one another as much as possible.
So it's been widely reported that you were treated more harshly than the others. Was it because of your race, Chris, or may it have been some other contributing factors, do you think?
No, I mean, nobody can tell me otherwise. It was absolutely because of my race and the color of my skin. From the beginning of the mission to the very last, and when I was released, everything they did was deliberate to try to psychologically break me down as well as physically. You know, the assault was one thing, and that was still a fraction of what Palestinians go through. The weaponizing of food.
What was the assault?
The assault, I was thrown to the ground by seven authorities. I was, and they put their knee in my back. They twisted both my arms behind my back. They levitated me, pulled my hair, used my chains to choke me to the point where I couldn't breathe. They threw me into a wall a few times. They separated me from the rest of the crew. And then they guarded me heavily throughout the entire process. But that was the very beginning. And at the end of the week, you know, I was one of the last to be released. That wasn't no coincidence. Everybody else was deported straight from Tel Aviv airport. But me and my Arab brother, who's also a brown man, you know, we were dropped off at the border of Jordan. Mm-hmm. And even with my flights home, they tried to make it miserable by sending me to two countries that are complicit in the genocide with Israel. So everything they did from beginning to end was blatant racism and bigotry. And I said this already, that in my 37 years in America, I've never experienced that amount of hatred and racism like I did in the few days that I spent in prison over there.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about, well, what was your average, your typical day like in the prison itself?
Well, it was seven of us in one cell. It was a heat wave. We're dealing with land sickness from being on the water for a number of days. So honestly, it was a lot of just disassociating myself, living in my head a lot, trying to pass time, very uncomfortable.
What does that mean, living in your head? What were you doing? What were you thinking? How'd you get through that?
Well, yeah, I mean, once again, the land sickness, for those who don't know, if you're on the water for a long time, and when you get on land, your whole equilibrium starts to rock like you're still on the boat. So, like, you can't really do much. You actually sort of hallucinate a little bit. You're on a hunger strike as well. So I was on a hunger strike. My body was probably just playing tricks on me. My mind was a little bit, you know, sort of low hallucinations. And I would be thinking about food, thinking about my family, thinking about my kids, that type of living in my head, like just trying to disassociate myself from reality of the harsh conditions we're dealing with, you know, mm-hmm. the bed bugs, to the heat, to the racist guards, to being raided by the raid unit a few times. You know, it just wasn't the inhumane conditions that we're dealing with. Would definitely take a toll on you if you didn't know how to keep your morale up. And a lot of the time I spent, you know, we were fortunate enough to have a room of guys that were on the boat with us. The others weren't, you know, we had two cellmates across the hall that were by themselves. But with seven of us in one room, we were able to have, you know, conversations and keep our spirits up until everybody was sent home.
Okay. And so what do you say to African-American people who say, why would you put yourself in that position? This is not our issue.
It's just ridiculous, number one. Number two, it's just like, you know, read your history. There's plenty of examples out there, from the Black Panthers to Nelson Mandela to Malcolm X. I know our history is being attacked. I know our history is being erased. And I know that it's not being taught in our classrooms. So it's not to blame everybody who said things like this. But there's a lot of stigmas that people keep regurgitating that wasn't created by the people. It's created by our oppressors. And that's what I remind folks when you're talking about a capitalistic society that we live in. And how does capitalism thrive? It thrives by division. It thrives by creating fear and doubt. And the reason why they don't want us to come together as people, prime example, the reason why Amazon doesn't want its workers to come together, because they know when workers or people come together, that is real power, and that we can actually have economic or political, or, you know, we can have leverage and power that is just unmatched. And by telling one demographic to sit out of this fight is what our oppressors want. They don't want Black people to stand up for Palestinians and vice versa. We just cannot allow that. We got to break these barriers down. And especially in the times that we're living in right now, the only way that we're going to get through these dark times in humanity is by coming together as people.
So Chris Smalls, having experienced what you experienced, would you go again?
Yeah, 1,000%. Absolutely. I'm already committed to that for sure. It won't be no time soon, but I definitely, hopefully we wouldn't have to do this anymore. Hopefully with these next few missions that we get some traction in breaking the siege. Once again, nobody on the Hundella or any of these flotillas, we don't want to do this. We don't want to risk our lives. We don't want to have to travel across the Mediterranean, the open graveyard, to try to break an illegal siege that's been going on for over 2 decades. We want to be home with our families and friends and live our lives too. But unfortunately, you know, our governments is failing us. So we have to do what we have to do as people. But I already said I will absolutely join another future flotilla to break the siege.
There's another major flotilla scheduled in the not so distant future. Do you happen to know that date? It's in September sometime?
Yeah, the next Freedom Flotilla, Samud, the global move from Samud, which 44 countries are going to try to break the siege. I will absolutely be supporting that flotilla mission. I will be behind the scenes this time. I will be able to, actually, I have a call later today with some of the folks. I'm going to be providing my experience, my trainings, experience as well, and give them as a great send off. You know, I'm here in solidarity with them through and through. And as far as the flotilla missions, I know they're planning on an all women's boat, women activists. I think that's a great initiative. And whatever happens after that, I'll definitely be involved with.
Okay. Chris, thank you so much for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake. And, you know, Chris Smalls, prominent labor organizer, noted for his smackdown of Amazon when he successfully organized, along with Derek Palmer, two Amazon shops into unionizing in his internationally noted trip aboard the Hundala board, part of the Freedom Flotilla, to Gaza to attempt to break the Israeli blockade and deliver food to starving people of Gaza. Chris, your boldness, your courage, compassion, and humanitarian spirit is a heroic profile in courage. Thank you so much for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
And with that, we continue our special programming with journalist and activist Norman Solomon. He is the author of many books, including most recently, War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. He is a co-founder of the Roots Action Network. Norman Solomon sees a thread connecting racism in America to how conflict is portrayed overseas. He takes a deep dive not only into current conflicts, but the history of U.S. warfare. This is Norman Solomon being interviewed by WPFW's Dave Rabin.
Norman, let's start off with the connections between racism and foreign policy. Talk about the difference between the mainstream U.S. media coverage of the war in Ukraine versus wars in Africa.
Well, it's notable, David, that after so many years when the U.S. media and the political establishment in Washington really didn't talk about systemic racism, after the murder of George Floyd and the strength of the Black Lives Matter movement, there was not enough, but more public acknowledgement and discussion of systemic racism, that it's not just about individual prejudice and bigotry, but it's about the institutions, the schools, the real estate industry, the government, the economy. So many institutional forces are racist, are discriminatory, and that's built into the economy and the ways that so many institutions function. So then you look at what happens outside the borders of the United States, and that discussion is not there. I mean, how often do we hear about institutional racism in foreign policy. And yet the idea that racism sort of stops at the water's edge in policy is patently ridiculous. So that's one element here where I think we need to take a really honest, confrontive look at U.S. foreign policy and how the racism that still is so present in our own society institutionally in terms of policies is really present and driving some of the train of foreign policy. And that really gets, I think, to aspects of your question, David, because for one thing, when I was working on this book, War Made Invisible, it struck me that when you examine what has happened since 9/11 and the so-called War on Terror, hidden in plain sight is the fact that virtually every person killed with Pentagon firepower has been a person of color. It's right in front of us, and it's not talked about. You don't see it in the Washington Post or the New York Times. It's not discussed. It's as I say, hidden in plain sight. And to be clear, I'm not saying that people in other countries in the U.S. so-called war on terror are killed because they're people of color, but because they're people of color, it's easier for the U.S. government to launch and sustain a war against them in terms of the attitudes, prejudices, and outlooks of the U.S. public and U.S. news media and people in political power. And that gets us to your question about Ukraine and, for instance, the invasion of Iraq. Two terribly unjust invasions with awful humanitarian results, crises, killing, maiming, terrorizing of so many people. In the case of Ukraine, quite appropriately, let's leave aside the propaganda about refusing to talk about NATO's impacts on the gathering conflict that led to the war. But in terms of the actual experience of human beings in Ukraine, the U.S. media, within the limits of media capacity and inherent in the technology, there has been tremendous effort made to convey to the U.S. public the suffering that the war in Ukraine has caused for the people of Ukraine. The Russians are appropriately condemned for that suffering being caused by the invasion and war on Ukraine. What a contrast to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, where there was very little of that. There was very little discussion of the suffering that was going on, the killing, the maiming, the anguish that was caused by the U.S. government. Well, there are a couple of elements there. One is that the designated enemy of the United States was doing the killing and maiming in Ukraine, whereas in Iraq, it was the United States government doing the killing and maiming. And that's one aspect. And another is that, as indelicately some journalists said right after the invasion of Ukraine, quote unquote, oh, the people of Ukraine, they, quote, look like us. And so there was that inherent ethnocentric and racist approach that was not so subtly, but not commented upon very often, infusing the coverage that we got, the political discourse about what was going on and still is going on in Ukraine in terms of the suffering, the victims of war there, but the victims of U.S. war on people of color in Iraq, it's been a very different story, very little of that kind of empathetic coverage.
And certainly we're not getting much coverage of what's going on in Sudan, Congo, Ethiopia. And when you're talking about the degree of suffering, the scale of suffering, it's far, far greater in those countries and other countries in Africa than what we have going on in Ukraine.
Well, the scale, you know, it's horrific everywhere. And the suffering in Gaza is, of course, horrendous, bankrolled by the U.S. If anybody knows somebody in Congress or working in Congress, wake them up. the United States is providing, literally making possible, the war on people in Gaza. And there is no reasonable question now that what is happening in Gaza is genocide. Last December, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch both issued voluminous reports concluding without any doubt, unequivocally, that Israel has been and continues to be engaged in genocide against Palestinian people in Gaza. Omer Bartov just published a very long, extensive, in-depth article in the New York Times, the foremost expert on genocide in the world, unequivocally documenting that Israel is engaged in genocide in Gaza. Again, these are Palestinian people who are being murdered with U.S. weapons. 75% of all of Israel's weapons are coming from the United States. So I think we could say, overall, there are two huge factors going on here. One is the geopolitical agenda of the United States government, which other nations it is aligned with and governments that it is aligned with, and also the ethnocentric racist aspects of what makes it so much easier for the United States to engage in war on and supply weapons to wage war on particular people.
Yeah. I mean, and the racism is insidious. I mean, we do, you know, as a predominantly white nation focus on victims that are white. I mean, I have two grandmothers from Ukraine, you know, born in Ukraine, and the identification, it's okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being concerned about victims of an aggression that we find unacceptable, but the racism involved is insidious. You know, you focus on Ukraine and then you don't have the focus on the people of Gaza. You don't have focus on Sudan, Ethiopia, Congo, and the media plays along with that, feeds into that. And in the meantime, enormous numbers of people are dying without recognition.
It is, as you say, it's very insidious. What we desperately need, the world desperately needs, with the U.S. the most powerful military force by far, is a single standard of human rights. And one would think that could be potentially easy to have, that single standard. But it's extremely difficult. You look at what is said on Capitol Hill, what is coming out of the White House, what's coming out of the news coverage of the Washington Post or New York Times or All Things Considered or Morning Edition, and the single standard is largely absent. And to compound the felony, as the saying goes, to make it even worse, is it's not only a double standard, it's that the United States is perpetrating so much of this suffering in wars, prominently now Gaza. And so it's, we might say, well, that's ironic. The United States is making this warfare possible in Gaza. And even so, we're not getting the kind of coverage that we should be getting, the kind of empathetic coverage and political outrage. Well, it's not only that it's odd, it's a double standard, it's hypocritical. You could make a strong argument, and I will here for just a moment, that it's largely because the United States is making the killing possible that we're getting this tremendous imbalance of coverage. And here's a quick example. For many years, beginning at the latter part of the Obama presidency, the United States was supporting the Saudi-led bombing and war on people in Yemen. And during that time, according to the UN, the largest epidemic of cholera in modern history unfolded because of the war in Gaza, or rather the war on Yemen. And so you would think, well, why wouldn't we get that coverage? And there was virtually no coverage of that, for instance, on MSNBC. Now, some people listening to us, David, here on WPFW might feel, well, you know, at least we're getting good coverage from MSNBC, the liberal MSNBC network, the Rachel Maddow network, where on primetime you can get this seemingly righteous coverage of the world. Well, in fact, it was quite the opposite. As the Media Watch Group Fair documented, there was 5,000% as much coverage of the so-called Russiagate scandal than what was going on in Yemen. There was virtually no coverage of that, the fact that the U.S. government was helping with weaponry and aid and sales of weapons, Saudi Arabia, to slaughter people on a daily basis in Yemen. And yet MSNBC wasn't covering that, was not covering it. And so you get to the bottom line, so to speak, and was it because, well, they just didn't want to cover it? Well, was it in spite of the fact that the United States was directly involved? Well, that seems to have been the case.
Yeah.
Maybe it was because the United States was so involved that we got virtually no coverage, for instance, from MSNBC of this terrible slaughter in Yemen.
Right. You've got this underpinning of racism, but then, of course, you also have the serious underpinning of the military-industrial, or as Eisenhower wanted to say, the military-industrial congressional complex, as evident in the Defense Department, which, you know, Orwell would have a heyday. It used to be called the War Department, but and then after World War II, it became the Defense. Everything is about defense, and they're making a lot of do-re-mi out of this. I mean, we talk about all the waste, fraud, and abuse that, you know, has been dealt with the chainsaw, but you've got a military industrial complex that's doing very well. I mean, it got larger. It's over what, $1 trillion now in the big beautiful bill, when everything else is getting cut, social safety net getting cut. But whoa, we can't touch our defense budget. If you could talk about that.
Yeah, a military budget. I wish at lowercase d it really was a defense budget. If it was, it would be much lower than the $1 trillion, that's for damn sure. And as you say, it's exempt from these huge cuts that are going on for well-being. Martin Luther King Jr. described this as a demonic, destructive suction tube. That's his phrase, a demonic, destructive suction tube that during the Vietnam War was taking huge resources away from healthcare, education, housing, infant care, elderly care, and putting it into the pipeline to kill people in Southeast Asia. And this is happening budgetarily today, and not only helping to kill, for instance, people in Gaza, but helping to kill by deprivation people in D.C., in San Francisco, in New York, in communities, towns whose names we don't even know, because of the funneling of money away from basic human needs. And that's pretty much the status quo that's gotten worse under the Trump administration.
Yeah, I mean, it's insidious and it is not being discussed. I mean, there was important discussions in the big, beautiful bill about the shredding of the safety net, but I sure was not hearing much in the mainstream media about the expanding of the Pentagon budget. I mean, it's just not being discussed.
Militarism is built in. Yeah, militarism is part of the echo chamber, the wallpaper, you might say, of the media echo chamber. It's accepted tacitly, which, as you say, that's a very good word for it. It's very insidious, and the cumulative effect is so destructive.
What do you say to those that say, going back to Gaza, hey, Hamas on October 7th did a horrible thing, killing over 1,200 Israelis? What do you say to those that say, we have to take out Hamas by whatever means necessary. I mean, you don't hear people saying, oh, the poor German people that were killed in World War II as we took out the Nazis. What do you say to those that say, hey, got to take out Hamas? They're terrorists. They're an abomination by whatever means necessary.
Hamas did do a terrible thing on October 7th, and the results were 1,200 deaths. The conservative deaths from the Israeli war on Gaza is 55,000, whereas on top of that, it's believed at least 10 or 15,000 are buried under the rubble, more than 100,000 maimed, genocide. And so if people take a position that genocide is okay because what happened on October 7th, that is just such a reprehensible attitude. It's infused in the real world so routinely with racism, with ethnocentrism, with the belief that a Jewish Israeli life is worth vastly more than a Palestinian life. This is the essence of a willingness to engage in genocide.
And that was Norman Solomon being interviewed by Dave Rabin. From WPFW 89.3, I'm Noah Portner.
For our next piece, we turn to what will unfold in Gaza after the war ends and after aid is restored to a population that has been fighting for survival every day for 2 years. And now, with ongoing airstrikes, a destroyed healthcare system, and close to a quarter of the enclave's population experiencing famine, Gaza faces a healthcare crisis for generations to come, and any plan for a post-war Gaza cannot ignore that reality. To more deeply understand what that means, last January we spoke with Grace Wade, a reporter at New Scientist magazine, where she posted a piece titled, quote, "The War in Gaza is Creating a Healthcare Crisis That Will Span Decades," close quote. And, as she explained to us, the conditions of war playing out now in Gaza and the loss of basic essentials of public health will have a profound and far-reaching impact.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really profound impact, right? I think we take for granted how important those things are to our everyday lives until they're gone. And it's really hard to imagine, yeah, just the severe impact it's having. Obviously, when you have a lack of food, you know, people experience malnutrition, even starvation, you know, many parts of Gaza are believed to be on the brink of famine. And this is really detrimental, especially for young children. And that's because it weakens their immune system, which leaves them more susceptible to disease. It also impairs their growth and development. But with the impact on the immune system, the reason this is so severe and so dramatic is because when you also don't have access to clean water or sewage treatment or trash removal, and you are living in a very crowded, dense area, infectious disease runs rampant, and being malnourished increases your risk of contracting an infectious disease. And so many children under the age of 5 are experiencing diarrheal diseases. And with a diarrheal disease, it wears down the inner lining of their intestines, which makes it harder for them to absorb nutrients. And so it really creates this vicious cycle. You know, one of the researchers I spoke with described it really tragically, horribly, as a snowball down to death, where you have malnutrition begetting more infectious disease and infectious disease exacerbating malnutrition. So it's really devastating and awful.
So deep is this devastation that Grace Wade writes, quote, The situation in Gaza is rapidly devolving into the worst humanitarian crisis in modern memory, close quote. And to gain more insight into that projection, we asked Grace Wade to elaborate further on how the impact of malnutrition, even after recovery, can be felt for a lifetime. According to the United Nations, the number of children admitted for treatment due to malnutrition has increased to 4,000 per month since July.
Yeah, so acute malnutrition for short periods of time, children can recover from very rapidly. But when you have persistent malnutrition early in life, it stunts growth, it impairs brain development, and that can cause all sorts of deficits in cognition, memory, motor function, intelligence. It also weakens the immune system, which can have lifelong impact. You know, it makes you more susceptible to infectious diseases. It also makes you more susceptible to cancer, heart disease, chronic diseases like that. Malnutrition in pregnancy also raises the risk of babies developing obesity, high blood pressure, and heart disease later down the line.
Another consequence of war in Gaza is the physical disabilities repeatedly brought about by Israeli airstrikes on the territory. A recent estimate by the World Health Organization found that after a year of war, more than 102,000 people have suffered injuries, including head and spinal cord injuries, major burns, and injuries requiring amputation. And here again, Grace Wade gives us insight into how these physical injuries will have an impact long after the fighting ends.
Well, I think with airstrikes, you know, we've already seen more than 1,000 children have had to have one, if not two or more limbs amputated. And that will have incredibly long-lasting impacts. Just thinking about rebuilding Gaza after the war, right? Like, you're going to have to factor in the fact that so many of the young children there have disabilities now, and it'll need to be accessible for them to move around. But also with airstrikes, the chemicals that are released with bombs, as well as with the destruction of buildings, those pollutants can increase the risk of cancer, heart disease, you know, chronic lung conditions years down the line.
Another consequence of war in Gaza is the physical disabilities repeatedly brought about by Israeli airstrikes on the territory. A recent estimate by the World Health Organization found that after a year of war, more than 102,000 people have suffered injuries, including hand and spinal cord injuries, major burns, and injuries requiring amputation. And here again, Grace Wade gives us insight into how these physical injuries will have an impact long after the fighting ends.
Well, I think with airstrikes, you know, we've already seen more than 1,000 children have had to have one, if not two or more limbs amputated. And that will have incredibly long-lasting impacts. Just thinking about rebuilding Gaza after the war, right? Like, you're going to have to factor in the fact that so many of the young children there have disabilities now, and it'll need to be accessible for them to move around. But also with airstrikes, the chemicals that are released with bombs, as well as with the destruction of buildings, those pollutants can increase the risk of cancer, heart disease, you know, chronic lung conditions years down the line.
According to the World Health Organization, at least a quarter of those injured in Gaza have life-changing injuries. And in a country devastated by war, the effort to shape a life while living with profound disabilities without some kind of intervention will be deeply compromised.
One, which I wouldn't say is unexpected, but it'll have impacts on people's ability to get a job later down the line. You know, they'll be really restricted into what sort of career they're going to be able to have. Just moving around is also going to be much more difficult, especially Gaza is absolutely war-torn right now. You know, just cars are struggling to move through the streets. So imagine how difficult it will be for someone in a wheelchair or who needs crutches. So it'll take a long time before they're going to be able to easily access, you know, home, healthcare, school. So that will have a lot of impacts on their quality of life and also, you know, their economic prospects in the future. And then also just the psychological impact of that, you know, it's hard.
In fact, the theme of the psychological impact
of the war in Gaza is a focus of Grace Wade's reporting. Considering that late last year, the World Health Organization estimated that 1.2 million children need mental health and psychosocial support for depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most widespread health impact from the war is going to be the mental health impacts. It's hard to even fathom, right, what the people living in Gaza are experiencing right now and how that is going to impact their mental health for the rest of their life. I mean, if you're struggling to feed your family and you're like, that is an extreme, like, if you're struggling to feed your family, if your loved ones are dying all around you, if you're scared a bomb is going to fall on your head at any moment, like, that level of traumatic experience is almost certainly going to increase the risk of developing post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, even, you know, more severe mental health conditions like psychosis. You know, this type of trauma can also really disrupt brain and organ development in young children, which increases the risk of learning disabilities later on. So again, that vicious feedback loop, right? And adults, research shows that adults who have childhood adversity have 12 times the risk of becoming addicted to drugs and alcohol and attempting suicide. You know, studies have also found that young men who survive conflict have triple the rates of severe mental disorders like psychosis. So it's going to be an extreme mental health epidemic for the people who survive this war.
Given these consequences, as Grace Wade reports, long-term health plans for Gaza must be established. However, as she also reports, most organizations have only just begun to do so. So what are some of the measures that need to be implemented?
I mean, I think the first one that comes to mind is making sure that the infrastructure is conducive so people with health conditions can easily access healthcare. So making sure the streets and sidewalks are easily accessible to people in wheelchairs or crutches, like I mentioned earlier. But also, I think it's going to be important to set up programs that are going to send people out to check on people regularly, you know, because if you're severely depressed or have severe anxiety, it's going to be hard to go to your healthcare provider on at a routine pace, right? So I think the infrastructure is the first thing that comes to mind, like rebuilding the strip so that people can access healthcare easily is going to be really important. There's going to be a high need for therapists and counselors and physical therapy rehabilitation programs as well. Absolutely. And therapists who speak the language and also familiar with the culture as well is going to be really important. It's hard to even think about all of the things that are going to need to be put in place.
So, in the face of such an unprecedented humanitarian disaster, the question Grace Wade sought to answer is what accounts for the lack of planning within international health organizations for addressing the territory's post-war needs.
You know, I reached out to tons of aid groups last year and asked them this question, you know, do you have long-term plans for how you're going to address these very real needs that we know will be there for decades down the line? And all of them, for the most part, got back to me and were like, it is so hard for us to plan for the future when right now we are struggling to even get basic medical supplies and food and water into the strip right now. And the sheer cost, right, too. So we're going to have all sorts of countries around the world shipping in aid in order to rebuild Gaza and then also implement those types of rehabilitation programs. Just thinking about rebuilding the hospitals and getting those functioning again to take care of acute needs, let alone long-term needs. I mean, it's an enormous undertaking that's going to have to take place. And I think right now for aid groups who are probably most likely or best poised to address those needs, it's hard for them to even think about that when they have such an enormous public health crisis on their hands right now. I think the other thing I would mention is, you know, one of the challenges in creating these long-term plans when I spoke with aid organizations is not only, you know, there's such a high amount of need right now and there's so much uncertainty about what Gaza is going to look like after the war ends. But they also haven't been able to effectively communicate with the few aid workers that they do have in the Strip. So Israel has essentially curtailed almost all of the aid organizations from sending humanitarian aid workers into the Strip. And then of the few workers that are there, they haven't been able to operate safely. Many of them have died from airstrikes. So that means they can't move around the region. They can't identify needs, and then they can't even communicate that back because communication lines keep getting shut down. So a lot of this postulating about the needs when we don't really even know what the picture looks like on the ground there, which makes planning even more challenging. Like, you know, you can create any plan you want, but it's sort of just building castles in the sky is what one of my sources told me.
That was Grace Wade, a health reporter at New Scientist magazine, where she posted last March a piece entitled, "The War in Gaza is Creating a Healthcare Crisis That Will Span Decades." To read her work, visit newscientist.com. That was Grace Wade, a public health reporter for New Scientist. Coming up next, a vigil to remember journalists killed in an Israeli attack last month. Stay with us. We end our show today with a reminder. Today marks a week that Israel staged an attack in Gaza that once again showed its willingness to resort to illegal and lethal means to silence journalists in Gaza. This past Friday, on the podcast of her WPFW show, On the Ground, host Esther Iverum shared with her listeners how the memory of these most recent victims of Israel's war on truth are being honored.
And finally, in culture and media, on Wednesday, there was a vigil and outrage rally to honor five journalists, along with rescue workers and others killed by Israel in a double missile strike on Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. The journalists killed were Mohammed Salam, cameraman for Al Jazeera, Hassam Al-Masri of Reuters, Mariam Abu Dhaka of the Associated Press, Moaz Abu Taha of NBC, and Ahmed Abu Aziz, a freelance independent journalist. This first voice is Palestinian-American organizer Hazami Bermada, followed by another organizer reading the words of Mariam Abu Dhaka, left for her young son, who she removed from Gaza when the attacks by Israel began.
We come here tonight in Washington, D.C., within earshot of NBC, MSNBC, Sky News, CNN, the U.S. Capitol, and Congress, because 2 days ago, on August 25th, Israel carried out yet another atrocity in Gaza. In a barbaric double-tap strike, a tactic globally recognized as a war crime, Israel intentionally targeted a hospital and the rescue workers rushing to save lives and those that followed to document the initial atrocity. In its first strike, Israel trapped people and injured them and killed some. The second strike deliberately killed the medics and journalists who rushed to the scene to help. Those are not accidents. Those are executions. Israel did not just bomb a hospital. It bombed the principle that medical workers are protected. It bombed the principle that journalists should never be silenced. It bombed the illusion of Western morality and ethics. And it bombed the belief that human life has dignity. Among those murdered were journalists. They were killed not because they held a weapon, but because they held a camera. Which to Israel, we have learned, is the most powerful weapon because it exposes their barbaric truth. I want to say their names together so that they ring loud and reverberate through the belly of the beast. The five slain journalists, please repeat after me. Muhammad Salim!
Muhammad Salim!
Muhammad Salim!
Muhammad Salim!
From Al Jazeera. Hussam Al-Masri!
Hussam Al-Masri!
Hussam Al-Masri!
Hussam Al-Masri!
From Reuters.
Maryam Abu
Dakka.
Maryam Abu
Dakka.
Maryam Abu Dakka.
From the Associated Press.
Muad
Abu Taha.
Muad Abu Taha.
Muad Abu Taha.
Muad Abu Taha.
Who worked for NBC.
NBC.
And Ahmed Abu Al-Aziz.
Ahmed Abu Aziz!
Ahmed Abu Aziz!
Ahmed Abu Aziz!
While Palestinian blood is fresh in the rubble, the American press are busy laundering lies to help Israel cover up their heinous act.
In a letter to her only child, Ray, shared on social media by her colleagues, Miriam wrote, "Hey, you are the heart and soul. Pray for me and not weep so that I may rest in peace. Make me proud by working hard, succeeding in your studies, and becoming a capable, accomplished young man. Strive to build a future for yourself, to become a respected businessman. My dearest, never forget me. Everything I did was to see you happy, comfortable, and fulfilled. And when the time comes when you marry and have a daughter, please name her Maryam after me. You are my love, my strength. My pride and my joy. Always carry yourself with dignity and let your actions honor my memory. Most importantly, I never neglect your prayers. Your prayers are your strength. With all my love, your mother, Maryam. Israel killed Maryam after she had been apart from her son for about 2 years. And her friends say, she would say she just longed to hug him and smell him.
At least 240 journalists have been killed by Israel in Gaza during the last 2 years, more than in previous wars of the last century combined.
That was WPFW host Esther Everam reporting last week on her podcast, On the Ground. In a follow-up to that story, on Monday, more than 250 news outlets around the world signed an appeal that calls for the protection of Palestinian journalists in Gaza, for foreign press to be granted independent access to the territory, and for the evacuation of wounded journalists in Gaza needing medical treatment abroad. Launched by Reporters Without Borders and the Committee to Protect Journalists, the appeal also calls for action from the international community and from the United Nations.